3. The Andropov Plan. Russia looms as a major global geopolitical competitor to establish a one-world government system sometime in the second half of the 21st century. Unless the United States allows its deterrent posture to erode over time or a strike by militant Islamists so weakens the country that Americans drop their guard, a Russian nuclear attack will remain unlikely. It is important to remember, however, that not much has changed between yesterday's strategic objectives of the Soviet Union and those of Russia today. One former Soviet KGB officer was quoted by J.R. Nyquist as saying his training identified Soviet geopolitical goals as being the vast infiltration of agents all over the globe. The communist plan, based on Lenin's teachings, was to take over the world without physical struggle. Nyquist quoted Cold War defectors as saying Soviet objectives were to extinguish capitalism and socialize, Marxize, the United States, separate Europe from America. Defeat the U.S. with a superior strategy backed by propaganda and disinformation, and reconcile with China to develop a scissors strategy. 1. The Andropov Plan, put into motion by Mikhail Gorbachev in 1988, maintained these goals but flipped the Soviet-Russian geopolitical strategy from open Marxism-Leninism and confrontation against the West to Antonio Gramsci's stealthy approach of cooperation and promotion of a quiet cultural transformation of capitalist countries. Moreover, reconciliation with China, close relations with Iran and Cuba/Brazil/Venezuela, and engaging progressive supporters inside the United States have collectively positioned Russia for long-term geopolitical competition with the capitalist West and militant Islam. Hidden deeply in the darkness of Russia's shadow world is a strategy that some in the West have called the Andropov Plan, named after Yuri Andropov, KGB chief from 1967 to 1982 and general secretary of the Communist Party from 1982 until his death in February 1984. Many in the West remain skeptical about the plan's existence and label it a legend. But there is a funny thing about hindsight, especially when seeing the whole of events from the tumultuous 1980s leading to the death of 20th-century Marxism-Leninism, followed by the chaos and mayhem of the 1990s. And finally stumbling into President Vladimir Putin's regressive years in the new millennium. A multitude of new facts have become evident from the writings of numerous journalists, researchers, and commentators of the world scene since the implosion of the Soviet Union. Collectively, when their perspectives are integrated with the glasnost, openness, and perestroika restructuring initiatives of Communist Party Chairman Mikhail Gorbachev in the late 1980s, it becomes quite evident that some kind of a plan was in place and that the KGB played a key political role in executing a wide range of covert operations necessary to implement it. Since the Andropov Plan was born under the cover of great secrecy, the covert actions that put it into motion were shrouded in a shadow world of deception and disinformation. The sheer enormity of the shift in the Soviet-Russian long-range deception strategy makes it a difficult story to tell. Yet, by comparing the Andropov Plan's strategic framework with key points of an alleged new disinformation strategy, old facts, as seen through the light of new evidence, make an informed historical interpretation possible. Former KGB officer Anatoly Golitsyn's memoranda for the CIA in the 1980s detailed the bold transformation of Soviet Russia's grand strategy that was designed to bring about a convergence of the capitalist West with the communist East on Soviet terms and the creation of a socialist world government as a solution to the arms race and nuclear confrontation. Two Golitsyn's warnings, however, were largely ignored by CIA analysts and swept under the rug as being useless disinformation. The evolution of the initial ideas rooted in today's Russian grand strategy to achieve global power and influence began as long ago as the late 1950s and 1960s. While striving to put the Stalin years behind them, it had become obvious to Soviet leaders that, despite their substantial industrial and military advances, Western economies would eventually outstrip their troubled economy and frustrate the attainment of the Kremlin's global goals. Something had to give. A new grand strategy was needed. With a boldness characteristic of the Russian character, the strategy developed through the Khrushchev and Brezhnev years in the 1960s and 1970s outlined an approach entailing an enormous realignment of the political and economic systems inside the Soviet Union to strengthen its long-term competition with the West. Yuri Andropov had a powerful voice in Soviet domestic and foreign policies. A master of duplicity and dedicated Marxist-Leninist, he was obsessed with suppression of dissidents inside the USSR and Eastern Europe. The speed with which the communist government in Budapest was toppled in the 1956 Hungarian uprising haunted him all of his life. His lesson learned was that the response to such situations had to be quick and hard through the use of military force. 3. Many experts on the Cold War Soviet Union regarded Andropov as the toughest and shrewdest Soviet politician since Stalin. He spoke reasonably good English with an American accent and was well-educated, sophisticated, and preferred scotch to vodka. Andropov climbed to the top over several decades through the support of several powerful party political figures. He exerted a considerable influence over the governing system during that period and was a longtime trusted advisor to Leonid Brezhnev during the period of stagnation in the 1960s and 1970s. Andropov was the KGB chief from 1967 to November 1982 when, upon Brezhnev's death, he became general secretary of the Communist Party. Brezhnev bequeathed two major problems to the new party leader: an economy in shambles that was forever falling further behind the West, and systemic corruption throughout the Soviet socialist governing system. These weaknesses had compelled the Eastern Bloc to turn repeatedly to Western banks for assistance. At the end of 1981, the East owed some $80.7 billion to Western banks, including $9.5 billion by the Soviet Union alone. At the same time, the East disguised rampant unemployment, since ideologically the socialist system ostensibly operated at full employment. Out-of-work individuals were seen to be personally at fault of social parasitism, and many were assigned to forced labor camps, more than 23,000 in Poland alone in 1983.4. One of Andropov's first moves as KGB chief was to restore the Committee for State Security, KGB, to its status as the world's most feared intelligence service and notoriously effective internal control agency. Harold Kim Philby, the head of the British Soviet section and a KGB agent, sought safety in Moscow in 1963 after some three decades of successful spying for the Kremlin. Philby and Andropov hit it off well and worked together to strengthen the KGB. At Philby's urging, Andropov made great efforts to improve the education and quality of KGB officers, a move that would pay off handsomely in subsequent years. Together, the Englishman and Russian developed KGB operatives who were socially comfortable at the highest level of diplomacy, business, and society throughout the world. Andropov's health failed him soon after he took the reins of power from Brezhnev, yet his focus remained on the struggling economy and corruption by party and government officials. Without ready answers to the problems ailing the socialist economic system in place, Andropov turned to Mikhail Gorbachev and a longtime friend and protege, Georgi Arbatov, director of the then-new USA Institute. Arbatov was regarded as the top Soviet expert on the United States, and Andropov had nurtured Gorbachev since 1971 to become a rising star in the party hierarchy. Like Andropov, Gorbachev was a dedicated Marxist-Leninist and embraced Lenin's slogan, "One step forward, two steps back," or retreat temporarily while pursuing long-term objectives that provided ideological direction for development of what was to become known among some as the Andropov Plan. Gorbachev was tasked to develop plans for the restructuring and reinvigorating of the economic and political systems to assure that the Kremlin stayed on the pathway toward the long-range goal of establishing a party-state-directed socialist world government. Gorbachev organized a host of task forces from the country's intellectual institutes and think tanks, commissioned 110 different policy studies, and integrated economists, scientists, technologists, computer scientists, educators, and labor and agriculture specialists. At the same, due to Andropov's ill health, Gorbachev was serving as his de facto deputy in running the party. Although Gorbachev was groomed to become Andropov's replacement, an aging and sick Konstantin Chernenko was next in line. After 11 months in office, however, he died, and Gorbachev ascended to General Secretary of the Communist Party in March 1985.6. Gorbachev's reform efforts confronted three bulwarks of power that were flourishing in Soviet society: the Communist Party, the nomenklatura or privileged elite in the party, and those occupying senior positions in government and the enterprises, and the KGB. A fourth, but far weaker power center, public opinion, was growing harsher at its condemnation of the corruption evident among three most powerful societal centers. Gorbachev's strategy addressed each of these power centers in a different way. Since successful reform of the existing socialist system would require popular support, Gorbachev tapped into the Soviet people by giving them a greater voice, albeit a well-monitored one, and freedom to speak out about their grievances with the current system in place. Hence, Gorbachev's glasnost policy was the key to giving the people an opportunity to let off steam and let their leaders know what they wanted. Glasnost was a long way from freedom of speech as known in Western liberal democracies, but it offered an essential opening that would garner popular support for the coming restructuring of the country's economic and political systems. Secondly, the Communist Party was persuaded to give up its monopoly of power and permit the formation of opposition parties. This was a big step since the party had guided everything and kept the Soviet people in a perpetual state of passivity, except for a few dissidents, religious believers, and Jews wanting to immigrate. 7. Thirdly, the approximately 1.5 million nomenklatura had to be guaranteed that they would continue to receive the resources necessary to sustain their lifestyle in the new order. And lastly, the KGB was given substantial political and economic power inside the new Russia and in its intelligence gathering and special tasks worldwide. The resulting strategy, perestroika, which had been under consideration, planning, and rehearsals since 1958-60, was larded with strong doses of deception and disinformation to mask the measures taken to satisfy the demands of the Communist Party, the nomenklatura, and the KGB. 8. The Communist Party did not renounce its long-term objective of marching toward a convergence with capitalism and establishing socialist world governance. While the world was focused on Gorbachev's acquiescence to the collapse of communist regimes in Eastern Europe, the tearing down of the Berlin Wall, and other monumental events, poof, the Soviet Communist Party turned invisible. Was communism dead as many in the West presumed, or did something else happen? 9. Did the world witness another example of Lenin's dictum of one step forward, two steps back? If so, where is the party located in its post-Soviet Russian structure, and how does it operate? These questions were not really addressed in any serious way as the Soviet Union imploded and the Russian Federation was born. Bits and pieces of information, events, and testimony that have emerged over the years beg answers to the open issues. Nearly 20 years have passed since the new Russia emerged from the rubble of the Soviet socialist system. The historical interpretation presented in this strategic analysis addresses open questions about the three pillars of the Soviet system: the Communist Party, nomenklatura, and KGB. In an effort to penetrate the deception and disinformation that were contrived to mask the whole truth, propaganda and disinformation are best when they are founded on selected aspects of truth, but not the whole truth, since even a scrap of veracity can ascribe credibility to the fictional tale. Nonetheless, when contradictory evidence begins to mount over the years, one may be able to grasp greater insight into what really occurred in Soviet Russia 20 years ago and during the two decades since. It is a tortuous path, but one worth taking. Deception and disinformation. Former KGB Major Anatoly Golitsyn defected to the West in December 1961 and began to tell Central Intelligence Agency debriefers the details of a new Soviet long-range, global deception strategy. At the time, he said that the plan was in the initial stages of development. The goal of the strategy was the creation of the conditions necessary for convergence of the East and West in establishing a socialist world government. Deception and disinformation were to be the primary measures used to reach these objectives. In Soviet eyes, disinformation is a far-reaching tool that creates images in the minds of others that will guide their behavior towards Soviet Russia. Like the shadows on the wall of Plato's cave, these images become reality to beholders who will resist changing their manipulated perceptions. Disinformation is more than simply disseminating false data through the media and agents of influence, propaganda. For Soviet Russia, influence operations were more about mind control, borrowed from the revisionist Marxist writings of Italian communist Antonio Gramsci, than simply reshaping public opinion. KGB disinformation operations are progressive. They are designed to mislead not the working people, but their enemies, the ruling circles of capitalism, in order to induce them to act in a certain way, or abstain from actions contrary to the interests of the USSR, They promote peace and social progress. They serve international détente. They are humane, creating the conditions for the noble struggle for humanity's bright future. The new Soviet strategy, identified by Galitzin, which later became known by a few in the West as the Andropov Plan, drew heavily from the experience of the Lenin's New Economic Policy, or NEP, in the 1920s. With the Soviet Union facing a full societal collapse in 1921, Vladimir Lenin and his cohorts used deception on a massive scale to encourage the West to come to the aid of the ailing USSR. The new economic policy had a different meaning for the West than Soviet Russia. To bait the profit hook, the Kremlin offered Western firms concessions in Soviet industry, reorganized its industries into trusts that operated on a for-profit basis, and invited Westerners to open new businesses in Soviet Russia. For the Soviets, the new economic policy meant economic recovery, expansion of foreign trade, attraction of foreign capital and expertise, diplomatic recognition by Western governments, and, at the same time, promotion of a worldwide communist revolution. Lenin believed that this aggressive policy could be effective only if it was accompanied by a well-conceived and executed deception and disinformation program. Point 11. With Soviet industry in ruins, agriculture in crisis, peasant uprisings, separatist movements, and the Russian people on the brink of revolt, disinformation was essential for concealing from the West a full dimension of the internal crises. By the time Stalin brought the new economic policy to an end in 1929, Soviet Russia had garnered a fistful of gains, including industry, agriculture, and trade that had all improved dramatically. Russia also had attracted large credits from the West, and new technology and equipment were brought into the country. Western firms had built essential factories, and, with American, British, German, and Czech assistance, the foundations for Soviet heavy and military industries had been put into place. In addition, the peasants were pacified, political parties liquidated, the independence of churches eliminated, and national movements crushed. The security service clamped down with effective societal controls, communist parties around the world increased their influence in unions and parliaments, and 12 new communist parties joined the Communist International Comintern, for a total of 46.12. In ending the new economic policy and calling for a socialist offensive on all fronts, Stalin canceled concessions for foreign industries and private enterprise in Soviet Russia, confiscated private property, collectivized agriculture, and intensified political repression. Point 13. Through deception and disinformation, the Soviets fulfilled Lenin's promise to create the conditions necessary for the capitalist West to become its own gravedigger. Despite the fact that Galitzin had placed the skeletal structure of the Andropov Plan into the hands of Western intelligence, mostly at the CIA and British intelligence, his claims were heavily discounted. He was believed to have spun wild conspiracy theories about the Kremlin's future actions. He said the Sino-Soviet split in the 1960s, for instance, was disinformation designed to deceive the West, and that the 1968 Prague Spring was a KGB deception. Galitzin's greatest supporter at the CIA was James Angleton, the legendary head of the CIA counterintelligence staff. But Galitzin persisted in spinning wild tales, such as the British Prime Minister Harold Wilson was a KGB agent. Later, we discovered that he was not far wrong about a Soviet mole positioned in the top ranks of the British government, only it was not Wilson but Kim Philby who served as a KGB agent at the top level of London's intelligence branch. By damaging his own credibility, Galitzin tarnished his own reports to the CIA on the development of a massive Soviet global deception strategy. The CIA's Soviet Analysis Division, for instance, simply rejected Galitzin's claims. This writer was told by one analyst that Galitzin is nuts, don't believe a word he has to say. It was bad advice, for history over the past two decades has validated Galitzin's warning. By failing to separate fact from fiction and allowing emotional responses to Galitzin's irritating personality, the FBI was equally unimpressed with Galitzin's demeanor. Sam Papich, Galitzin's FBI debriefer, is quoted by Mark Reibling as having said that the defector was a bright, arrogant bastard. He even tried to ask us questions to improve his knowledge base. 14. The problem with the CIA and FBI grand trashing of all that Galitzin had to say is that his many predictions had a curious way of proving correct over time. They missed it. In 1994, Mark Reibling assessed Gallitzin's predictions in his 1984 book New Lies for Old. He found that out of Gallitzin's 194 predictions expressed in his book, 139 were fulfilled by 1993, 46 were not falsifiable at this time, and 9 were clearly wrong. Yet critics piled on, focusing on the handful of Gallitzin's false predictions and not giving him credit for a 94% accuracy rate. Some went too far as to say his analysis strained credulity and accused him of being a demented proponent of cosmic theories. Wild theories or not, it seems that no one took the time to separate fact from chaff in Gallitzin's memoranda to the CIA. Gallitzin had provided the CIA a top-secret analysis in 1982 that alleged a tidal wave of changes would soon be forthcoming from the Kremlin that would set the new strategy, the Andropov Plan, into motion. Point 15. By placing Gallitzin on an official assassination list, the Soviets may well have tipped their hand that much of his testimony to the Western intelligence community was valid. First, in an obvious effort to smear Gallitzin, the KGB alleged he was a smuggler and defected because they were on to his criminal actions. Secondly, Soviet damage assessment after his defection concluded that he had been able to betray a wide range of intelligence to the CIA. Third, the KGB issued instructions in early 1962 to 54 overseas agents of influence of the actions they should take to limit the damage incurred from Gallitzin's defection. Point 16. Fourth, given that Kim Philby, KGB agent, was still the chief of the Soviet section at British intelligence early in Gallitzin's defection, one should suspect that character assassination of Gallitzin was also on Philby's agenda. And fifth, the KGB chief Vladimir Semichastny approved a plan for special actions against a group of particularly dangerous traitors, including the assassination of Anatoly Gallitzin. Point 17. If Gallitzin was such an unbelievable flake, why would the KGB stretch so far as to silence him? Were the details of Gallitzin's early CIA debriefings shared with the British MI6? If so, with Kim Philby in the Kremlin's pocket, the KGB had an open feedback channel about everything Gallitzin said. The plan. The Soviet-Russian grand design governed the Kremlin's internal and international initiatives over an extended period toward winning its strategic objectives in the geopolitical competition with the capitalist West and Islamic Salafism/Wahhabi. The Andropov Plan was set into motion in the late 1970s or early 1980s by shifting gears from confrontation to cooperation with the West. Russia later would orchestrate operations with its strategic partners, China, Iran, and Cuba/Brazil/Venezuela. Perestroika, the penultimate phase of the Gorbachev's reforms, unleashed a flood of covert special actions by the Central Committee of the Communist Party. These main tools were used to flip the political economic system from Soviet Marxism-Leninism to Russia's democratic and Bolshevik market reforms. The party mounted a massive strategic disinformation program to mask its grand design, while continuing a clandestine political role by the Federal Security Bureau, a happy face mask for the KGB. The deception also included use of a controlled political opposition to give Russia a more liberal image in order to convince the West that Russia was moving rapidly toward a democratic, non-communist government. Point 18. An initial problem with moving toward democracy under the perestroika was the absence of political opposition parties to compete for power. Alexander Yakovlev, Gorbachev's perestroika mastermind, was clear about how they solved the problem. "We created our own opposition. 19 since no one was standing in the wings ready to enter the political fray. The contrived origin of the Gorbachev-era opposition was created by the Communist Party." American scholars Peter Redaway and Dmitry Glinsky found that an indispensable role in this process was assigned to the Moscow party machine, from December 1985, presided over by Boris Yeltsin. 20. Gallitzin argued that perestroika would include the deployment of a controlled political opposition, dressed up in democratic and anti-communist garb. "No other truly independent candidates exist," he said. Point 21. Gallitzin also contended that the emergence of Vladimir Zhirinovsky as a vocal Russian nationalist was not a spontaneous political development. Rather, Zhirinovsky, as a hard-hitting ultranationalist, was invented to forestall the emergence of legitimate right-wingers and to allow Russian leaders to play the Zhirinovsky card in discussions with Western officials. Point 22. The idea of a controlled political opposition, was certainly a logical aspect of Andropov's long-range deception plan. It was also consistent with KGB contingency plans ready during the period of emergency to keep a lid on the political turmoil anticipated during the transition to democratic government and a free market economy. Christopher Story, British editor of Galitzin's The Perestroika Deception, explained how a key Russian stratagem to reshape the way in which the West viewed Russia was based on the ideas expressed by Italian communist Antonio Gramsci in the 1930s. The Marxist renewal and re-emergence process that emerged in the West following the ostensible death of communism in Russia is consistent with Story's foreword, written in the mid-1990s. Ambition to control the Western mind is a long-standing objective of Soviet policy, embracing the ideas of the Italian communist Antonio Gramsci, who argued that mastery of human consciousness should be a paramount political objective. Control of the Western mind is to be achieved not only by the dishonest use of language, but also to demoralize the West through corrosive attacks on society's institutions, the active promotion of drug abuse, and the spiral of agnosticism, nihilism, permissiveness, and concerted attacks on the family in order to destabilize society. Religion and the traditional cultural and moral hegemony must first be destroyed before the revolution can be successful. When Benito Mussolini seized power in Italy in 1922, ending the rule of the king, Victor Emmanuel III, Antonio Gramsci, then chairman of the Italian Communist Party, was surprised that the exploited Italian workers did not take advantage of the situation by rising up against their capitalist exploiters in a massive proletarian revolution. Later, while imprisoned by Mussolini in the 1930s, Gramsci wrote his thoughts of this and other societal issues in his notebooks. He asserted that the Roman Catholic Church had inculcated the Italian people with an unassailable value structure, allowing the church to exercise mind control over the people's political actions. Gramsci concluded that, because workers followed the values learned from the Catholic Church, religion must be destroyed, and the church's mind control approach must be emulated by communist leaders. The Andropov plan, based on mind control techniques and its deception and disinformation strategy, shifted the dominant ideology from Marxism-Leninism to the revisionist Marxism of Antonio Gramsci. 24. Communism in Russia did not disappear, it simply converted to a more subtle and, for the West, more dangerous form. Cultural Marxism. The critical assumption that the ongoing culture war in the United States somehow just happened does not stand up when placed under scrutiny. The radical left successfully deconstructed American society by undermining moral values and traditional institutions, thereby opening the door to the Gramscians who would move into positions of political authority and begin a process of convergence with Russia. With the collapse of Marxist-Leninist communism in Russia in 1991, the Western parties and other ultra-leftists began the implementation of Gramsci's revisionist Marxism as the basis for new strategies to culturally transform the Western democracies. The Gramsci madness began almost simultaneously among the hard left in Europe, the United States, Australia, New Zealand, and Latin America, suggesting a coordination of a new anti-Western doctrine. In light of the events surrounding Perestroika and the possibility of the Gorbachev Foundation serving as a cover for activities of the former International Department of the Soviet Communist Party, can one legitimately infer that Soviet Russia traded Marxism-Leninism and confrontation with the West for Gramscian Marxism and ostensible cooperation with Western democracies? Are Russian clandestine activities in deception and disinformation, Federal Security Bureau covert political operations, and extensive use of agents of influence in Western countries moving forward as predicted by Anatoly Galitzin? Implementing Perestroika. In a March 1990 memorandum to the Central Intelligence Agency, Galitzin was adamant, "Western blindness to the strategy behind Perestroika is rooted in Western ignorance, ignorance, and ignorance." 25. Perestroika operations took place at two levels, one in the open and a second in the underworld. The first actions were a series of events, a grand theatrical display that stunned the world, the release of the Kremlin's hold on East European and Central Asian client regimes, the tearing down of the Berlin Wall, the withdrawal of Soviet forces from Eastern Europe, the reunification of Germany, opening Russia to Western visitors and businesses, and the dissolution of the Soviet Empire itself. Momentous events inside Russia rushed forward, including formation of political parties, democratic elections, a free press, and a madcap rush to convert Russia to a market-driven economy. All of the bells and whistles of a modern democracy and free enterprise economy were soon in place, albeit with considerable chaos and mayhem. Europeans and Americans were stunned, giddy with delight. We, a generation of cold warriors, finally had pulled the communists down. These were heady times. The combatants in the Cold War standoff could look forward to peace and prosperity. The West turned to helping Russia make its transition as smooth as possible with aid, training, advice, and encouragement. For seven decades, the essential entrepreneurial skills needed by Russia had been painstakingly mined out of the Soviet people by the communist system. Meetings between American and Russian scientists, educators, military officers, and cultural groups began building a new bridge of cooperation and mutual understanding. The good humor and camaraderie often experienced between Americans and Russians could very well have led one to conclude that they actually liked each other on a personal level. A second level of perestroika activities took place in the shadows, invisible to those of us still celebrating the easing of tensions in the Soviet-American nuclear standoff. One reason for missing the clues about what was going on is that we simply were not looking. Like hungry fish, we took the perestroika bait, accepting the gift, without serious examination or debate. Our experts told us communism was dead and Russia reborn was on a pathway to modernize humankind's standard of democratic government and free market economies. Francis Fukuyama went so far as to say it was the end of history. But some of us had an itch. There was something too pat about the whole transformation and the sudden lurch from communism to democracy/free markets. Pieces to the puzzle were missing and others did not quite fit. Finally, we set our suspicions aside as being a paranoia hangover from the Cold War and quietly accepted the portrait of the reinvention of Russia painted for us by the party's disinformation image makers. In Russia's perestroika underworld, however, the KGB operated at a fast pace to move the party's treasury and whatever could be looted from the Soviet state out of the country and into the West, where financial resources could be invested for use by residual elements of the international department of the now invisible Communist Party. While some KGB men were slipping out the back door into the West, others marched through the front door into top positions in major Soviet industries in order to take advantage of privatization called for by the Andropov plan. Yuri Andropov had made provisions for these strategic clandestine moves during perestroika by sending several KGB officers to the West in the late 1970s to learn the secrets of capitalism and for-profit operations. According to the Malden Institute, the highly trusted KGB officers were expected to garner new experiences and develop new skills. Upon their return, the KGB men reported on their investments and helped develop a new toolkit of skills for use by intelligence officers in making future investments in the West Point 26th. This preparation for what was to occur later under the rubric of perestroika, as guided by Mikhail Gorbachev, was almost certainly on the Andropov's initial agenda, as well as a democratic leader, such as the role filled by Boris Yeltsin in the 1990s. The results would be a decade-long flow of funds from the West, transfer of economic skills, cooperative arrangements, direct investments, and new technologies transfer that took the Soviet economy off life support. Point 27. It seems quite clear from 20 years of hindsight that the model for the Andropov plan was drawn from Lenin's new economic policy that successfully boosted Russia's economy in the 1920s, only to be followed by the harsh years of Joseph Stalin's totalitarian rule, or an example of Lenin's strategy of one step forward, two steps back. During the late 1980s, the Communist Party dipped into the Soviet state's financial resources and used them as if they were its own. The party also controlled billions of dollars worth of property and investments. All of these assets were available to protect the some 1.5 million nomenklatura or party elite as they passed through the revolving door leading to the death of the Soviet Union and birth of the Russian Federation and Commonwealth of Independent States, CIS. According to Stephen Handelman, a veteran foreign correspondent and former Moscow bureau chief for the Toronto Star, the Central Committee prepared a secret list of names of the most worthy party members. Their place on the list was their personal passport for special appointments, including top government officials, ambassadors, and other senior positions. The Nomenklatura constituted a private club of individuals whose loyalty to the party transcended any other obligation, Handelman explained. Point 28. A key step in implementing the Andropov plan was taken at a plenary session of the Central Committee of the Communist Party. At the urging of Mikhail Gorbachev, General Secretary of the Central Committee, at a February 5, 1990 meeting, the party voted to revoke Article 6 of the Soviet Constitution. The major impact, Handelman explained, was elimination of the party's right to appropriate government monies to fund overseas operations by the party and the KGB. According to documents from the party archives that Handelman was able to review, this decision appears to have been the trigger that led to the quiet transfer of party funds to secret bank accounts and enterprises outside of Russia. Several of the party banks also served as money laundries for huge dollar deposits from Colombian and Panamanian drug dealers. The drug money was converted from dollars to rubles and then reconverted to dollars again in return for sizable commissions. Another currency shenanigan took the money resulting from the sell-off of Soviet military property in East Germany in Soviet rubles, which were converted to East German marks. Later, they were exchanged for West German Deutschmarks at the time of reunification of the two Germanies. The party, Handelman discovered, reaped enormous profits. Point 29. In the months just prior to and during Perestroika, Moscow's foreign trade bank transferred billions of dollars to fake banks and commercial enterprises in the West. Most of the money went to Greece, Cyprus, Italy, and Portugal. Another aspect of the KGB's money-making toolkit was exercised through shipments of oil, metal, and timber to KGB-sponsored overseas enterprises. The raw materials were purchased at a fraction of their sales value. When the resources were sold at world market prices, the resulting profit went into the party's black treasury. Point 30. Soviet gold reserves amounted to 1,300 tons, about $30 billion, in the early 1980s. Once Perestroika was set into motion, about 1,000 tons were sold. Meanwhile, the Soviet Union's foreign exchange reserves tumbled from about $15 billion when Gorbachev entered office in 1985 to just $1 billion. Further evidence of the Andropov plan is shown in a memo uncovered by Paul Klebnikov. KGB Colonel Leonid Veselovsky, first chief directorate, sent a secret memorandum to Nikolai Krikina, who was in charge of property for the Central Committee of the Communist Party. Veselovsky's memo urged Krikina's support in creating a network of captive banks and trading companies, both in Russia and abroad, to collect billions of dollars of government funds during the period of emergency, Klebnikov reported, and keep them for the communist nomenklatura until a more propitious time arrived. Additional insight to the plan is in Klebnikov's quotation of the Veselovsky's memo. The earnings which are accumulated in the party treasury and are not reflected in the financial reports can be used to purchase the shares of various companies, enterprises, and banks. On the one hand, this will create a stable source of revenue, irrespective of what may happen to the party. On the other hand, these shares can be sold on the security exchanges at any time and the capital transferred to other spheres, allowing the party to keep its participation anonymous and still retain control. In order to avoid mistakes in the course of this operation during the period of emergency, it is essential to organize, both in the USSR and abroad, special rapid response groups, staffed by specially trained instructors from the active reserve of the KGB of the USSR, as well as by trusted individuals volunteering their cooperation and by individuals who, for one reason or another, have lost their job in the field units or administrative departments of the KGB of the U.S.S.R. 32. The privatization of Soviet state property was also an insider's game. Nearly 47,000 state companies had been placed mostly into the hands of company managers and the nomenklatura by the end of 1992, 90,000 enterprises a year later. These transfers from public to private ownership at minimal cost set the foundation for fabulously wealthy oligarchs during the 1990s. Chaos and hardship often marked the economic reform of the 1990s, but the privileged elite benefited greatly by the backdoor privatization process. Point 33. The oligarchic culture that emerged during the 1990s was hardly new. Russia's ruling elite, going back to the days of the Tsars, were often alienated from the Russian people. This oligarchic culture, Redaway and Glinsky observed, accentuated in the Soviet period by the Bolsheviks' paranoia and their constant need to combat enemies of the revolution, provided fertile soil for the rapid decay and mutation of the Bolshevik revolutionary elite into the nomenklatura, a conservative and privileged ruling class isolated from society. 34. For nearly a year leading up to August 19, 1991, the possibility of a KGB coup against Gorbachev, staged or otherwise, was an open secret. Peter Redaway and Dmitry Glinsky examined the August coup in their 2001 book, The Tragedy of Russia's Reforms, for the United States Peace Institute. They called the coup a riddle and asked three questions. 1. To what degree was President Gorbachev involved in the preparation of the coup? 2. To what extent was he denied communications during the coup? And 3. Why did the plotters want so badly to meet him after the coup's collapse? 35. In a 1991 memorandum to the CIA, Anatoly Golitsyn asserted that the Soviet coup and its failure constituted a grandiose display of deception. 36. On the other hand, Major General Oleg Kalugin, once the KGB's top spy against the United States and now retired in the Maryland suburbs of Washington, D.C., told this writer in a 2005 discussion that the coup was legitimate, though an ill-founded one and the result of insider positioning for power. Nevertheless, the evidence simply did not fit in the explanations given to Westerners. According to Golitsyn, the activities surrounding the coup were calculated displays intended primarily for the West. 37. It was used for a spectacular display of the influence of Russian Democrats and Boris Yeltsin's courage in defending the Soviet parliament. This event, combined with tearing down that wall in Berlin and removal of the statues of Vladimir Lenin and Felix Dzerzhinsky, the Knight of the Revolution, who headed the Chaika, the first Soviet security and intelligence agency, were staged to underline the ostensible death of communism and the end of the USSR. Golitsyn explained these symbolic changes as being essential for erasing the image of Soviet repression and terrorism from the Western mind, as well as fostering the convergence of the capitalist West and democratic free market Russia in a socialist world government. Redaway and Glinsky cited factual evidence that may well validate Golitsyn's assertions. Gorbachev, a day before he left Moscow for a vacation in the Ukrainian Crimean Peninsula, observed that emergency measures are needed. In emergency situations, all states act and will act accordingly. Tomorrow I will leave for vacation, with your permission, so as not to impede your work. 39. Insofar as the second question, Gorbachev twice telephoned Arkady Volsky, chairman of the Scientific Industrial Union, while he was supposedly being held incommunicado by the coup plotters. And a Ukrainian KGB officer denied reports that Gorbachev had been held in isolation. Even without Redaway and Glinsky's factual accounts, it is difficult to see how the president of the Soviet Union could say one day that emergency measures were needed and walk out the door and go on vacation the next day. But if it was a staged coup, what was in it for the Kremlin? Redaway and Glinsky believe that since Gorbachev's primary objective in 1990-91 was to somehow find a way to secure Western financial assistance, presenting the specter of an unstable nuclear-armed Soviet Union could be so frightening to the West that aid would be forthcoming quickly to stabilize the country. The coup, real or contrived, was followed by 4 months of rapid deterioration and, finally, the disintegration of the USSR. The anti-Western, anti-democratic, and anti-market forces, as well as the Soviet institutions underwriting these ideas, collapsed. The Soviet Communist Party disappeared, and the power ministries, the KGB, Army, and Ministry of Interior, Internal Security, were dismantled. The Soviet Union was terminated on December 31, 1991. The KGB was tasked to maintain some sense of control during the instability created by the political and economic reforms. A robust KGB served as a guardian that bridged the transition from old to new. A document recovered from the KGB archives, as reported by Handelman, provides keen insight into the political role played by the KGB in the Andropov plan. KGB document number 174033, dated January 5, 1991. Relayed coded instructions from KGB Chairman Vladimir Kryukov. He directed the creation of private firms to sell military technology overseas. In light of the domestic turmoil surrounding the shift from a communist system to a Western-style capitalist one, Kryukov also outlined three strategic objectives. Private companies, he ordered, would serve as reliable covers for KGB leaders and the most valuable KGB operatives in case the domestic situation develops along East German lines. Provide financial means for the organization of underground work if destructive elements came to power, and create conditions for the effective use of foreign and domestic agent networks during a period of increased political instability. Klebnikov described how the KGB, neither an organ of the Soviet state nor an operation of the Communist Party, operated on its own, ignoring for the moment whether an invisible international department of the former Soviet Communist Party was parked at the Gorbachev Foundation. Not only was the KGB busy squirreling away Communist Party funds, but it controlled the privatization of Soviet state property and infiltrated and sponsored leading organized crime groups. 41. The KGB was an important secret player, perhaps the most important, in bridging the criminality of the old regime with the criminality of the post-communist era, Stephen Handelman concluded. The privatization program during the final days of the USSR, which was controlled by the KGB, witnessed the transfer of some 3 billion rubles, about $120 million, for creation of some 600 newly established commercial firms and banks around the country. Once implemented, the Andropov plan surprised many of the party elite, including Gorbachev, that invoking public opinion would give such a strong impetus toward economic reform and political restructuring. Tens of millions of Russians participated in the first Soviet elections, raising their expectations sky high. Gorbachev noted that perestroika had become a truly nationwide movement. 42. For Russia, the 1990s was a decade of painful transition. Stumbling through these years of economic turmoil, chaos, and gangland violence, the new Russia carried out privatization, stabilized the ruble, developed a balanced budget, and strengthened important government institutions. By the end of the 1990s, Russia had laid the groundwork for the free market, including the civil tax and land codes, pension legislation, and deregulation, loosening the government chokehold on business activities. The net result was a tumbling gross domestic product and an economy that hit rock bottom in 1998. Russia had collected a basketful of problems. Foremost among them were the machinations of the oligarchs who dominated economic life and strongly influenced political activities. The Russian government, for instance, could not function without the oligarchs buying treasury bills. These problems in the years of President Boris Yeltsin provide a backdrop for the hired gun brought into town at the end of his tenure. Vladimir Putin's meteoric rise to the presidency was engineered by the security and intelligence heavies in the Kremlin. First, Putin was appointed in 1998 as head of the Federal Security Service, FSB. In September 1999, a series of bombings destroyed four apartment buildings, killing more than 300 people. The bloody results were broadcast across the country, inflaming a popular sense of outrage. Self-defense groups were formed in various parts of the country, and the people demanded personal safety. 43. From the beginning, the Putin-led FSB blamed the Chechens for the two bombings in Moscow and two other cities. The man who would become president promised retribution. They will, Putin said, be wiped out in their SH houses. 44. These were words the Russian people could understand, and Putin's popularity rocketed through the roof. Yet, questions remain unanswered as to whether the bombings were a result of FSB efforts to open the political leadership door for one of their own. Appointed Russian Prime Minister by Yeltsin in 1999, Vladimir Putin was elected president in March 2000 with 54% of the vote. In power, Putin was confronted with an increasingly corrupt government, oligarchs in control of large sectors of the economy, and regional governors who wielded immense personal power. His task was to put the Andropov plan back on track and complete the final stage of the long-range deception and disinformation strategy, convergence with the capitalist West and creation of a socialist world governance. Vladimir Putin. From the start, Putin set a course for Russia to establish itself as a major geopolitical competitor against the economic globalization designs by the capitalist West and restoration of a world caliphate by militant Islam. Putin moved quickly to prepare for the long-term geopolitical competition that lay ahead by developing a number of political tools. The Andropov plan unfolded in two phases, the first, The Gorbachev reforms so reminiscent of the 1921-29 new economic policy and, secondly, a retrenchment, though somewhat constrained, to promote the discipline and focus required to compete for world power. For 9 years in Russia, the 1990s looked a lot like the 1920s. While the economies of the capitalist West and post-Soviet Russia converged, Moscow reaped great benefits through investment, transfer of skills, training, finished consumer goods, and assistance for democracy building and creation of a free market. The privatization of state-owned property, however, placed a wild card in the deck. The plundering of Russia's riches converted the chosen ones of the nomenklatura into millionaires overnight. A few took their consumption at the public trough to astounding heights and became billionaires in a very short period, then turned their resources into political voices with moneyed muscle behind them. The oligarch family supporting President Boris Yeltsin, through their uncoordinated gluttony for wealth and power, were hijacking the Andropov plan midway through its execution. The risks associated with the Andropov plan included the chance that, once the Soviet-controlled economy was unleashed and political controls were relaxed, the plan would be taken off track. The order by KGB Chief Kryukov in January 1991, document number 174033, that called for the creation of underground agent networks to be used during increased political instability, reflected an awareness that just such events might occur. The road from Soviet socialist economic and political systems to a managed economy and managed democracy appears to have been a bit rockier road than predicted by Gorbachev and his perestroika gurus in the 1980s. The freebooting oligarchs and others of the super wealthy elite were sending the Andropov plan spinning out of control. These activities triggered a response, unsurprisingly, by the conservative pro-discipline advocates who had been or still were members of the traditional power ministries KGB, military, and internal security in the Soviet system. In a face-off at the end of Yeltsin's presidency, they reached an agreement on who would be the next democratically elected president. A seemingly rather pedestrian former KGB lieutenant colonel with a modest record of success, Vladimir Putin, was their agreed-upon compromise. The oligarchs would come to rue the day that they cut this deal. They soon discovered that they had greatly underestimated Putin's political skills and hard-nosed dedication to instilling discipline in Russian society and restoring the country to a position of world power. President Putin instituted governmental adjustments by bringing a small horde of former KGB officers into key positions. As the succession of events that ushered Putin into the presidency in 2000 unfolded at an ever greater pace, he moved quickly by bringing into government hundreds of people experienced in Soviet security measures, eliminating powerful regional governors and replacing them with his own appointees who reported directly to him, and taking preparatory moves for the coming political assault against the oligarchs. 45 under Putin. The final phase of the Andropov plan under Putin was put back on track. The power of the former politicians, bureaucrats, military leaders, intelligence officers, internal security men, known as the Siloviki, was greatly increased. Peter Redaway, a professor at the George Washington University, notes that Chekistry, the Chaika, were the first Soviet secret police, is sometimes used synonymously for Siloviki, since the latter is dominated by former KGB officers. 46. More than 6,000 Chekists, former KGB and Foreign Security Bureau officers, followed Putin into office. By 2004, Anna Politkovskaya reported that they were occupying the highest offices in the key ministries. 47. Even before Putin was elected president on March 26, 2000, he ordered a monument and plaque commemorating Yuri Andropov be returned to their former places of honor at the headquarters of the Foreign Security Bureau. Olga Krishtanovskaya of the Russian Academy of Sciences in 2004 exposed the extent of the Siloviki penetration of the Russian government. As reported by John B. Dunlop at the Stanford Institute on International Studies, Krishtanovskaya's convincing analysis revealed that about 34% of Russian top officials were Siloviki, as well as some 18% in the Duma or parliament. Putin, she said, in essence has structurally recreated the Politburo of the Central Committee of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union, where the governing core was 58% Siloviki. The heads of the Foreign Security Bureau, Foreign Intelligence, Defense Ministry, and Ministry of Internal Affairs under Putin were all Siloviki. 48. Krishnanovsky's analysis also showed that 78% of Russia's political and business elite were Siloviki. The impact of their presence was being felt in the restrictions on the media, censorship of school textbooks that strayed from historical facts and that could provide grounds for new political infighting, and an assessment that democracy tends to be seen as a potential source of instability. Russia's contemporary ideology is statist. In the eyes of President Putin and his Siloviki supporters, Russia needs less debate in the parliament, media, and elsewhere in the country. State interests are judged as being far more important than individual interests. 49. With his presidency packed with men with guns, Putin turned to the oligarchs, focusing sharply on the billionaire Big Three, Boris Berezovsky, Vladimir Gazinsky, Mediamost, and Mikhail Khodorkovsky, Yukos Oil. Each of them presented Putin's rule with an independent political force. The first two used their control of television and radio to underwrite their political activities, while the latter applied his riches from oil, natural gas, and metals to win political muscle. It did not take Putin long to chase the Russian billionaires Berezovsky and Gazinsky out of the country and jail Khodorkovsky for fraud and tax evasion. According to Michael McFaul at the Hoover Institution, Khodorkovsky may have drawn Putin's ire in the spring of 2003 when he had the temerity to suggest that Russia needed a parliamentary democracy rather than a presidential republic. The 8-year jailing of Khodorkovsky, McFaul says, was the execution of the latest change for regime change in Russia, autocratic regime change. 50 Russian prosecutors opened an additional investigation of Khodorkovsky in February 2007 for money laundering and embezzlement. Fresh charges were leveled in June 2008, facing the once freewheeling oil tycoon with up to an additional 15 years imprisonment. 51. Boris Berezovsky, one of the tycoons exiled in London, accused Putin of plotting to murder him and called for the nonviolent overthrow of the Russian government. Russian prosecutors in April 2007 were filing criminal charges against Berezovsky allegedly for looting $50 million from Aeroflot, and said they would ask Britain to eliminate his political asylum status and extradite him to Moscow. Another step deemed necessary by Putin to consolidate his control of Russia was the suppression of dissent by those most harsh in their criticism of the new president. 13 journalists and writers critical of Putin were killed under mysterious circumstances and others left the country in a self-imposed exile. 53. American journalist Paul Klebnikov, editor of Forbes Russia, was murdered as he left work in Moscow on July 9, 2004. He was gunned down in a gang-style execution. As he lay dying after being shot 4 times, he could name no one who might have wanted to kill him. Some speculated he may have made few friends in Chechnya because of his published appeals to Europeans to protect the Christian civilization against Islamic extremism. Others thought that Russia's security services could have believed that he knew too much. 54. His book, Godfather of the Kremlin, published in 2000, provided many details about the KGB's covert activities during perestroika that may have been enough to order his assassination. Before she was murdered in her apartment in October 2006, Anna Politkovskaya sincerely lamented what she believed was a return to the old Soviet ways. As the Czechists have become entrenched in power, we have let them see our fear, and thereby have only intensified their urge to treat us like cattle. The KGB respects only the strong. The weak it devours. We of all people ought to know that. Like cancer, bad history tends to recur, and there is only one radical treatment, invasive therapy to destroy the deadly cells. We have not done this. We dragged ourselves out of the Soviet Union and into the new Russia still infected with our Soviet disease. 55. Ultimately, Anna Politkovskaya fell prey to Russia's new governance, gunned down in Moscow. As negative images of Putin's Russia began to grow in the West, Russia's chief prosecutor Yuri Chaika announced in August 2007 that 10 people had been arrested for the murder of Anna Politkovskaya. He insisted that the contract killing was ordered by someone outside of Russia, intimating oligarchs in exile were responsible. Chaika's announcement occurred before the charges were prepared and the names of the accused were leaked to the press. Among those charged were 3 former police officers and a police major of the FSB, successor to the KGB. Some believed government officials were taking extraordinary measures to ruin the case, especially against the police officers, and propaganda began to flow like sour wine. Chaika insisted that Polkovskaya's murder was an attempt to destabilize the country, change its constitutional order, return to the old system where money and oligarchs decided everything, discredit the national leadership, and provoke external pressure on our country. 56. The voice of another Putin critic and collaborator of Politkovskaya, Alexander Litvinenko, was poisoned to death in London a month later. Similar to a Hollywood espionage thriller, London police and Scotland Yard discovered traces of a mysterious radioactive substance at a restaurant where Alexander Litvinenko had dined. Later, it was discovered that he had been poisoned with a difficult-to-obtain substance called polonium-210, which is used to reduce static electricity in many industries. 97% of the world's polonium-210 is produced at the Avangard nuclear reactor located 450 miles outside Moscow. Like hounds, British law enforcement traced polonium-210 traces to aircraft that had visited Moscow and Germany. The tangle of numerous factual threads were brought together by a steadfast British law enforcement. Conspiracy theories galore were spun about the assassination by polonium-210. Some argued that rogue agents inside the FSB did it. Others say no, the killers were former KGB. A few thought billionaire Boris Berezovsky did it. A couple believe Litvinenko poisoned himself. Most observers, however, assumed that Litvinenko had gone too far in his criticism of the Russian president, and Putin ordered his killing to shut Litvinenko up and to deter others. 57. The Litvinenko murder threw a pail of cold water on the Western image of the new Russia. President Putin is widely assumed to have had a hand in the poisoning. Regardless of whether this is a fair or unfair judgment, the dreaded picture of a KGB-controlled Russia has been dredged from the wreckage of the Soviet Union. The Politkovskaya and Litvinenko murders, plus the killing of American journalist Paul Klebnikov in Moscow, reflects a creeping coup of the democratic and free market Russia that the West had been celebrating. The West's wake-up call was long in coming. In the end, the British accused Andrei Lugovoy, a former KGB officer, of poisoning Litvinenko and sought his extradition from Russia to stand trial for murder in Britain. Russia refused London's request, citing its constitution which prohibits extraditing Russian citizens to other countries. The British responded by expelling three Russian diplomats, and Russia answered by ordering the return of three British diplomats from Moscow. The London-Moscow row left the Litvinenko matter standing without a resolution. 58. Andrei Lugovoy was elected to the state's Duma, Russian parliament. In December 2007, on the platform of a radical nationalist party that generally supports the Kremlin's policies. 59. In retrospect, these events should not be surprising. The Andropov plan disassembled the Soviet Union, turned the Communist Party invisible, and left the KGB standing with a new political role. KGB document number 174033, January 1991. An order issued by KGB chief Vladimir Kryukov, a protege of Yuri Andropov, directed the agency to create conditions for the effective use of foreign and domestic agent networks during increased political instability. 60. Already at a high level, Russian espionage, especially against Europe and North America, surged under the presidency of Vladimir Putin. The Russian Foreign Intelligence Service, SVR, replaced the foreign spying tasks of the first directorate of the Soviet KGB. Michael Kozakovich, who characterizes the SVR as being a leaner, if not meaner, successor to the KGB's first directorate, found the service to reflect several interesting tendencies in Russian thinking. He noted that SVR activities demonstrated a strong gloss of Russian nationalism, especially in the areas relating to the multipolar objective, preserving and enhancing Russia's international status, and protecting Russia from intervention from the outside. 61. These highlights of an effective and professional corps of Russian foreign intelligence officers should not be surprising. Gorbachev had a close interaction with Yuri Andropov and the KGB during his political ascent and the run-up to perestroika. Soviet KGB defector Oleg Gordievsky was quoted by Waller as saying that Gorbachev's new thinking was powerfully influenced by his many briefings by the KGB. 62. Throughout the ups and downs of perestroika, the KGB delivered successful results and remained unscathed. The KGB was a coveted wild card during perestroika, for it was entrusted to serve as a bulwark against the processes of change tumbling into anarchy. And Gorbachev smartly never used his immense political capital to touch the Chekists, 63 thanks to a still robust KGB hiding behind the names of Federalnaya Sluzba Bezopasnosti, Federal Security Bureau, or FSB, and Sluzba Nezhnyaya Razvedka, SVR. President Putin entered office with sharpened and familiar tools to help with his governance. It did not take long for President Putin to wield the sword of the SVR. Britain's Jane's Intelligence Service reported in November 2002 that Russia was engaged in a massive stepping up of espionage activities in Europe and North America. The SVR intensified its recruitment of members of Russian émigrés living abroad. Coercive techniques to win émigré agents in foreign lands included threats to fabricate prosecution cases against them prior to leaving Russia. If the target would refuse, extradition charges were immediately initiated. Putin and the SVR also preyed on Russian entrepreneurs who were operating successfully in the West. The Russian president, for instance, is said to have ordered the investigation of the owner of a successful metallurgical factory in Switzerland. Meanwhile, the Czech Republic, a country of 10 million people, plays host to a Russian embassy staff numbering more than 400 diplomats. The Czech Republic is a target-rich country for the SVR and its coercive recruitment, since tens of thousands of Russian businessmen live and work in the country. In North America, the SVR has stepped up its intelligence operations in large Russian immigré communities in New York, Miami, and Toronto. 64. In March 2004, President Putin was re-elected with a stunning 70% of the vote. And this confidence expressed by Russian voters was after Putin had already made some extraordinary moves to impose some discipline on the democratic and economic systems. Always Yuri Andropov's answer for dealing with social unrest and economic weakness. The Russian people expressed the belief that Putin would establish a more honest government and secure society. 65. By the summer of 2005, however, a significant erosion of support for Putin's government was evident. The late Yuri Levada, director of the Moscow Center for the Study of Public Opinion, said that two-thirds of those polled affirmed their support for democracy, but strong pluralities rejected the concentration of power in the hands of the president. The economy, under Putin, is a curious hybrid of the free market, ideological dogma, and other features, Russian investigative journalist Anna Politkovskaya wrote shortly before her murder in 2006. It is a model that puts Soviet ideology at the service of big-time private capital. 66. She also described Putin's new old nomenklatura, saying that they had taken corruption to heights undreamed of under the communists. In 2004, she said, they were devouring small and middle-sized businesses and with them the middle class, in favor of the nomenklatura's preferred source of bribes, big and super-big businesses, the monopolies and quasi-state enterprises. 67. The middle class, of course, is an essential aspect of free market democracies. Anna Politkovskaya took her knockout swing at the Putin presidency by summing up, they're hankering Putin and his cronies. After the old times is increasingly reminiscent of the thinking in the Soviet Union during the height of the period of stagnation in the late Brezhnev years, the late 1970s and 1980s. 68. How does this iron-fisted one-time KGB agent Putin, columnist Arnold Bachman asked after Politkovskaya's murder, differ from the bloody days of Joseph Stalin? 69. Gorbachev had an answer. The system was not working when Putin came to power. He had to move to stop disintegration. Russia 2008 presented two faces, one looking forward and another back. The push and pull between these separate forces deep inside the Russian psyche leaves many in the West quizzical. Is the Russian government democratic or non-democratic, liberal or authoritarian? As is often the case with Russia, unambiguous answers prove elusive. People living in Moscow and other urban areas are doing quite well with an economy growing at an average of 6% annually and real income jumping by about 10% a year. People have money in their pockets and they are spending it on a wide array of consumer goods that only a few years ago were but an unattainable dream. But the backward face of the Russian Janus shows nearly a third of the population living on just $350 a month, the country's healthcare system in shambles, and other critical human needs unmet. Both faces represent the real Russia. Meanwhile, the KGB, which was given critical political roles to play in during the implementation of the Andropov Plan, performs important functions in assuring state security. Yevgenia Albits, a Russian investigative journalist quoted by Fred Weir in the Christian Science Monitor, described the contemporary situation this way. The Kremlin has built a system in which one man, Putin, is responsible for everything. The KGB is in power in this country, their man is president, and they conduct their affairs as in Soviet times. 71. In a series of steps reminiscent of Stalin's shutting down the new economic policy in 1929, President Putin moved to crush all independent challengers to his one-man rule. With the big three oligarchs out of the picture and the remaining super-wealthy cowed into obedience, Putin turned his sights towards any independent areas still remaining in Russian society. The political parties were gelded. Businessmen learned how to play ball by Putin's "I always win" rules, and most civic society groups modified their behavior to satisfy the model demanded by the Kremlin. The final stage of the Andropov Plan seemed well underway in 2008.72. The business community adapted to the reality of quietly paying their taxes to keep the Siloviki bloated government running and contributed soft dollars in protection rackets run by the Putin power men. Firms that cooperated were protected from overseas competition and strict regulations. While the Putin government works to root out corruption, the favored companies, such as Gazprom, an energy giant run by Putin cronies who siphoned some $20 billion from the company during the first term of the Putin presidency, get special treatment. President Putin's promise to manage democracy also produced authoritarian fruit. Following the star of his hero Yuri Andropov, Putin believes most problems can be resolved through discipline at the knee of a dictator. When Garry Kasparov, the legendary Russian chess champion, tried to apply his strategy skills to organizing an integrated opposition to Siloviki rule, the Kremlin took strong action. Kasparov attempted to bring Russia's fractured opposition groups together to speak with a single voice. When about 4,000 members of the Other Russia gathered at Moscow's Triumph Square, just a short walk from the Kremlin, to voice their concerns with Putin's policies, they were met by police and military forces that heavily outnumbered the demonstrators. Several skirmishes occurred, and as many as 600 were arrested. The police also had raided Kasparov's offices a few days before the demonstration, seizing what they called extremist literature. 73, this is not the geopolitical monster of Soviet times, Kasparov said. This is all about money. The government is business. It's about Gazprom. It's about Rosneft. Putin leads a ruling elite that has very different dreams than in Soviet times. They're all thinking about their great life in the Côte d'Azur. 74. In July 2007, President Putin signed into law an expansion of the definition of criminal activity to include such action as public slander of public officials and humiliating national pride. Andrei Pyatkovsky, a brave critic of Russia's President Vladimir Putin and a resident scholar at the Hudson Institute in Washington, D.C., found himself in a Moscow court in September 2007 accused of inciting violence against Russia. Pyatkovsky, a mathematician and creative thinker, denounced the charges as absurd and primitive. 75. The two government manuals are used as a basis for development of textbooks that foster a national ideology and vision of the Russian people with their own national identity, a kind of reverse Gramsci formula. At the same time, Americans are blamed for creating new international tensions. From the beginning of the 1990s, the U.S. tried to realize a global empire. The new teacher's manual explains, one of the U.S. strategies was to isolate Russia from all other former Soviet republics. 76. In addition to the education manuals, 10,000 14 to 28-year-old Russian commissars, the old Soviet word, gathered at a youth camp in July 2007 to prepare to eliminate challenges from opposition groups to the Putin government. The pro-Kremlin Nashi organization cheers President Putin and is dedicated to restoring Russia to superpower status. The vision ahead foresees a vast network with virtually all Russian youth being members of Nashi. The slogan of the new commissars is "Let there be sovereign democracy," or a democracy without Western influence. The organization already has grown quickly, extending branches to most of Russia's 85 regions. At the summer camp, Russian youth combine patriotism with self-improvement, all of which is very similar to the Soviet Komsomol. The idea is to channel the energy and enthusiasm of Russian youth in the service of the state. Kremlin officials often speak at some of the Nashi functions, including President Putin in July 2007.77. The Kremlin's efforts in turning back the clock, such as Putin's comparison of the United States with the Third Reich, are paying off. A summer 2007 survey of 1,802 Russians, ages 16 to 29, is telling because this Putin generation represent Russia's political and economic future. The majority of Russian youth viewed the United States as public enemy number one. Nearly 80% believe the U.S. is trying to impose its standards on other countries, 75% thought Washington offered aid to interfere in other countries, and 70% agreed that the United States does more harm than good. The top words selected from five in the survey that best described the United States were enemy or rival, 64%. This same cohort agreed that Stalin did more good than bad, 54%, and 63% agreed with the proposition that the Soviet collapse was the greatest geopolitical catastrophe of the 20th century. 78. The Putin government has already prepared the next generation of Russians to carry on the Andropov plan to a successful geopolitical conclusion. The Kremlin has drawn the lines in the sand demarcating the struggle for the coming one-world government. The propaganda message is clear. Hey, West, don't complain. Putin will prevent a return to the old ways. These opinions, plus the political murders of Paul Klebnikov and Anna Politkovskaya in Moscow and Alexander Litvinenko in London, make the years 2006 to 2007 appear as a turning point back to the life in the days of the Soviet Union. The major difference in 2008, thanks to rising energy prices, found Russia floating in money. The Deutsche Bank in Russia estimated that the country will have the fifth largest economy in the world in 2020, with a $2 trillion economy in 2010.80. The ordinary Russian, however, was growing increasingly restless about the turn of events, so much so that many yearned for the hard but predictable days of the Soviet Union. In December 2006, celebrations of Soviet leader Leonid Brezhnev's 18-year rule were widely attended and included a flurry of exhibitions, films, and television documentaries. While most Russians spoke approvingly of Brezhnev's rule, one sensed that something was missing in the new Russia. His was a time when the rest of the world treated the Kremlin with respect. 81. A 2006 Levada Center poll showed that a staggering 61% of the respondents regretted the fall of the Soviet Union. They missed the religious-like comfort of Marxism-Leninism or an ideology that could help make their hardships more bearable. In the absence of an ideology to provide a code of conduct to live by, the people were left uncertain and restless. 82. The 64 million ruble question in 2007 was over who would succeed President Putin, or would he be succeeded at all? Having served the constitutionally allowed two terms in office, Putin announced he would not run for a third term. Then the search for political wiggle room began. From Western news reports, most Russians would be very happy to have Vladimir Putin as a permanent president. 83. A variety of alternatives were sent up as trial balloons. Putin could serve as prime minister with power over a presidential puppet. He could go fishing and possibly return in 2012, or the constitution could be changed. Masha Lipman, a keen observer of Russian political affairs, noted that the Russian public isn't any more concerned about adherence to the constitution than is Russia's ruling elite. 84. The succession of Putin to Putin occurred in two steps. First, the United Russia Party, listing President Vladimir Putin as its candidate, won 64% of the vote, or 315 of the 450-seat State Duma parliament, on December 2, 2007. This sizable majority is more than enough to pass any legislation or amendment to the Russian constitution. Second, in the presidential election held on March 2, 2008, Putin's deputy prime minister Dmitry Medvedev won with about 68% of the vote. This step opened the door for President Medvedev to transfer all significant decision-making powers to the office of the prime minister, Vladimir Putin's new office. In the process, these steps transformed the country into a parliamentary republic. While none of this finagling resembled democracy in action, from all indications the Russian people do not care. They want Vladimir Putin in charge. He is the one who rescued them from the hardships and deprivations of a 1990s associated with capitalist plundering and gangland violence. Putin is the one credited with improving the lives of millions of Russians. After the March elections, President-elect Medvedev said that we will, now, be able to preserve the course of President Putin. Russian political analyst Dmitry Orshkin is quoted as having put the facts of life in Russia this way. The parliament is loyal to Putin. The security services are loyal to Putin. The mass media is Putin's. Any independent step by Medvedev will be considered a declaration of war on the current elite, and they will strike back. Energy superpower. Russia has about 1,700 trillion cubic feet of natural gas reserves, more than any other country, and it is the world's largest exporter of the resource. The country's proven oil reserves number 60 to 74 billion barrels, most of which are located in western Siberia. Gazprom, a Russian government-controlled oil firm, outlined plans to quadruple its $251 billion market value to become the world's first trillion-dollar firm by 2011.86. In order to prosecute its geopolitical competition against the capitalist West and Salafism/Wahhabi, President Putin took advantage of Russia's plentiful natural gas and oil resources and its transcontinental size and central position in Eurasia by crisscrossing the country with pipelines to fuel an energy-hungry world. When oil and natural gas prices rose shortly after President Putin's accession to power, the Kremlin had more cash to fund its worldwide geopolitical operations. In addition to the normal conduct of the business of foreign sales of gas and oil, some $200 billion a year, Gazprom serves as a domestic stick to end free speech in Russia and a foreign policy tool to be used as leverage to compel the convergence of Europe and Russia from the Atlantic to the Ural Mountains. Gazprom Media assumed control of Russia's last independent television station after Putin had closed its operations. The Gazprom Media firm also bought two once-independent newspapers. Meanwhile, Gazprom Invest Holdings, the company's financial arm, purchased another newspaper and fired the editor. The newspaper's military correspondent had a fatal fall from a third-story window. 87. The convergence of Europe and Russia remains a key driving force to restoring Russia to its natural home as a European power. Nevertheless, Europe still looks toward North America and its transatlantic identity rather than toward the Urals. The convergence project dreamed up by the Kremlin's geopolitical competitors should be recognized as a calculated assault against the capitalist West. Russia supplies about half of the European Union's natural gas, which gives Moscow considerable economic clout. Past energy supply cutoffs to Ukraine and Belarus, as well as the Baltic countries, placed Europe on notice of its vulnerability. Cruise missiles and a nuclear umbrella might have prevented the Red Army from rolling across Europe, Erwin M. Selzer concludes, but they are no match for supply cutoffs that can throw the West into economic recession and freeze consumers. As the storm clouds rise once again to the east of Europe, the capitalist West is floundering. The refusal by Americans and Europeans to recognize that the post-Cold War party is over and their failure to develop a common strategy vis-a-vis an energy-muscular Russia is self-defeating. The Kremlin recognizes that its energy resources place it in a position to peel Europe away from the Atlantic Alliance, which would put the United States into a substantially weakened competitive position. Top Russian and Belarusian officials have been discussing the possible merger of Russia and Belarus since they signed a union agreement in 1996 that envisioned a close political, economic, and military convergence. With the transition of Mr. Putin to prime minister completed, the time may be right for Russia to offer Belarus President Alexander Lukashenko an offer he cannot refuse. While Russia plays a game of economic warfare against them, the Europeans do little more than wring their hands. The Kremlin's game is replete with energy blackmail and financial arrangements hidden deeply in the world's shadows. By 2008, Moscow had scored victories in influencing the energy infrastructures in Lithuania, Latvia, and Estonia, as well as in Georgia, Ukraine, Moldova, Bulgaria, Armenia, and Greece. At the same time, Turkey, holding important supply routes, was drawing its energy policies closer to Moscow. Meanwhile, Europe, which has no enforceable common energy policy, should not expect to compete effectively with a Russia that plays by a different rulebook, Ambassador Keith C. Smith at the Center for Strategic and International Studies concluded. Europe seems mesmerized by the energy warfare swirling around them, Smith added. The Russians are world-class chess players, while the European and American competitors play gentlemanly amateur croquet.